would be a word that you would use to describe how you feel right now? Sad, anxious, pessimistic. Sorry? Shadowed? Shattered. Sorry? Pathetic. Disappointed. Worried, powerless. Anger, perhaps. Disbelief. Hopelessness, perhaps. And these are some of the very feelings that people have when they are hit by a tsunami or an earthquake or in the midst of a war. So these are absolutely common and natural feelings to have, given what we are seeing every weekend, every day, perhaps. One thing to remember is that these are natural responses. And also that for some of us, we might feel that our feelings are changing over time, right? Fluctuates from hopefulness to hopelessness to hopefulness, from anger to sadness to fear. And that's also very natural and common. Our bodies are designed to react to threats. So imagine if you're crossing a street and there is a vehicle coming at high speed, and your normal reaction would be a startled response, and that would perhaps prompt you to escape so that you're safe. So in each and every one of us, we have that built-in alarm system to help us to stay safe. But oftentimes in the midst of a disaster or in the aftermath of a disaster, that alarm system would go off randomly, right? So perhaps even in the midst of safety, you would have all sorts of flashbacks. For some people, it might be nightmares. For some people, it might be needing to avoid certain topics or certain places, right? And that is also very normal. That is our body telling us to remember that was dangerous. Don't put yourself in harm's way again. But of course, even though most of us would naturally recover from this, our alarm system would, our fire alarm within ourselves would retune itself over time. And that's the good news. Most of us would be okay after a while. But some of us might still continue to experience that kind of startle response or anxiety or fear. And that's when we know that perhaps we would need a little bit more help. And there are indeed services that are available in our community to help those who have longer-term impact, who have been impact longer-term. But one thing to keep in mind is that these two are normal, right? That you're not going crazy. It's part of how we are designed to respond to situations that are potentially harmful to us. So it's important for us to understand that everyone is affected in Hong Kong. Some of us are directly exposed. Some of us might have loved ones who are directly exposed. But everyone, regardless of where you stand in the political spectrum, you've been exposed to this trauma, right? But not everyone exposed to trauma would be affected by the trauma, right? And not everyone affected by trauma would have longer-term traumatic responses. So the one thing to keep in mind is that these responses that we are feeling right now, or the ones we, or you might know people who might be very affected by this, that is normal. But not everyone who is affected would have longer-term issues. Okay. The second thing to remember is that the timing of our responses can be very different. For some people, it might be very immediate. They might feel very hopeless or anxious when they are seeing what they're seeing. But for some people, they're okay initially, and then later on, they start experiencing some of the things that I just mentioned. They might start to have nightmares or have flashbacks or start to feel that their thinking is very clouded, that their bodily responses are out of whack. Some people might feel in their body, very somatic. They might start having headaches or stomach aches or body aches that they can't explain otherwise. And that too is possible. For some people during this time, they're able to remain calm, but that doesn't mean that later on feeling these things is abnormal. That too is part of what we often see in the aftermath of large-scale disasters. So timing can be different, our responses could be different, and the way we cope with these feelings that we have can be very different as well. I believe each and every one of us have had experience other types of challenges in life, right? Might not be political in its nature. It could be health, it could be relational, it could be related to our jobs or our education. The same things that you did to overcome those challenges, chances are they would be helpful in this situation as well. So one thing we can do during this period, this crisis, is to remember the things that we used to do to help ourselves feel better. Right? Perhaps there are some of the tools that we've used in the past that were effective that we have forgotten that they were useful. So it's perhaps a chance for us to revisit some of these things that we do to help ourselves feel better. And it's also a good time to remind each other what are some of the things that you find helpful that they can perhaps also try too. Right? For some people, it might be to sleep. For people, some people might be to listen to music. For some people, it might be prayer. For some people, it could be watching a movie. Or for some people, it might be simply distracting themselves. These are all good in the short run. And it's okay to have many different tools. In fact, that is recommendable, to have many different tools so that if one thing doesn't work, you can rely on something else. And we also know that one of the most robust form of support is from friends and family, right, and loved ones. Right? This is a time to use those relationships wisely, to prioritize relationships, even though people might have very different opinions about what is going on. But we know that perceived sort of support, meaning that knowing that if there is, for example, if there is an earthquake right now, who are you going to call? Is there someone you can call for help? Right? Having that number, that person that you know that if you need help, they will come to your rescue, is tremendously protective. Unfortunately, a lot of people don't even have that. So we can serve as that person for those who don't even have a person that they can call. So social support is very important. Okay. So if we were to remember anything from tonight's sharing, there are five things that we can do to help ourselves and others. The first thing is that we need to, when we're safe, we need to know that we're safe. A lot of people in the midst of this kind of crisis feel that they are not safe, right? And it's easy to not feel safe when, you know, perhaps 200 meters from here, you know that something is going on. And it's, of course, it's good to know that perhaps in this kind of situation, you have to go from somewhere dangerous to somewhere safe. But once we are safe, it's important for us to know that we're safe, right? And learn to calm ourselves down. Because in the longer run, those who feel that their lives are threatened tend to have more complicated mental situations afterwards. So one thing to help ourselves and those around us is to help us feel safe, right? Of course, when we're not safe, objectively speaking, we should go, you know, find a place that is safe. But once we are safe, objectively speaking, we should learn to help ourselves calm down and help those around us to calm down, right? Another thing that we can do is to help us learn that we can solve problems collectively. What is what psychologists call efficacy. We have to learn that we can solve problems. Of course, there are huge political problems that we can't solve, or at least not I can't solve those problems. But there are things in our everyday lives as we are facing this crisis we can do together to help build that sense of efficacy. Right? If the problems are too enormous, we can break them into smaller chunks, and then we can focus on the easier tasks first, and then gradually, once we build that confidence, we can go tackle the more difficult ones. Right? And of course, hope is very important in the midst of a crisis. So how do we remain hopeful? And I think the church, with capital C, has a role to play here to remind ourselves that where our hope comes from. And I think this is a tremendous opportunity for us to show the rest of Hong Kong or the rest of the world how it is possible to remain hopeful when there seems to be no hope in the situation. Okay. And of course, as I've said, social support is tremendously important. So one of the things that I've been asked a lot in recent weeks is how do we handle what we are seeing. If it's like a one-off situation, I think for most of us would be okay. We have enough resources to take care of ourselves and those around us. But it seems like this is happening every weekend and bleeding into weekdays as well and weeknights. So one thing that very practical that I think we can all try to do is to, well, two things. One is to sleep. I like to joke that the reason why we're in this crisis right now is because Carrie Lam does not sleep. She is proud of the fact that she only gets 4 hours of sleep. But scientifically, that probably is not a good idea. We know that when we are sleep deprived, our judgments are affected, it is harder for us to regulate our feelings. We tend to like food that is high in fat and sugar when we are sleep deprived. So you think that going on a diet through not sleeping, that's actually a very bad idea. So sleeping allows us to consolidate our memory to help us deal with difficult emotions, right? And if we are sleep deprived, that would, in the long run, that can be translated into all sorts of health and mental health problems, especially when we are under so much stress. Because the things that we see on TV, even though you might not physically be there, but they do affect us. After 9/11, a lot of researchers discovered that even watching, even being exposed to the footages of, you all remember, those of us who are old enough, of the horrific scenes that we saw on TV over and over and over and again, that is sufficient to traumatize a lot of people. So that changed the way we understand trauma. It doesn't have to happen to you directly. Even through hearing stories of others, or witnessing, or seeing it through your smartphone or on TV, that too can, especially for those who are vulnerable, psychologically vulnerable, that too can create a lot of distress. So one thing we can help ourselves is to, in fact, I recommend everyone in Hong Kong, if we want to do something for Hong Kong, this is one thing we can do, is to modulate our consumption of news, it's important to stay informed, but it doesn't really help that much to watch the same footages over and over and over and over again. There is temptation to do that because it's exciting. There is something inherently addictive to this kind of visual stimulation, right? And we know that by now, we know that the things that are fed to us through social media are literally designed to keep you on the screen, keep your attention. That is what those billion-dollar industry is trying to do. So it is very difficult for us as individuals to fight against such a huge industry on our own. So one thing that we need to learn to do is to resist that temptation. Right? It's important to stay informed, but we need to know where to get our news updates and how often. For some people, perhaps twice a day is sufficient. For some people, maybe they can handle a little bit more. But at least I think given that this is a marathon, not a sprint, I think it is important for us to maintain a certain healthy lifestyle so that we can continue to support those around us. And that entails resisting the temptation to keep watching certain footages, because that can affect us. And of course, we know that a lot of these are happening in the evenings, and I'm sure most of us have experienced nights of sleeplessness because of what we are watching or what we've watched before we went to bed. So for some people, it might be helpful to develop a habit of not using your phone or tablet or not viewing anything from a device perhaps 15 minutes or 30 minutes or an hour before you go to bed. Right. So that's something practical that we can consider doing. So I talked about sleep. I talked about the way, if you will, a media diet. Right. And also the actual food diet. We know that from various research studies that the health of our gut affects our mood. It can even, in animal models, it even affect behaviors. So in some ways, we know that being healthy in terms of our diet can help improve our mental health. And our mental health, of course, would affect the way we eat as well, right? So that's important to know, that we need to keep up a healthy diet during this time so that we can run this marathon. And speaking of running a marathon, we need to pace ourselves. This is not a sprint. So in running a marathon, I've never run a single marathon, but I'm guessing you can't carry the same mentality as you would run in running a sprint. Meaning that you have to pace yourself, you have to take breaks perhaps, you have to drink water during the race, right? Because this is a marathon, we need to give permissions to ourselves and those around us to rest and to take breaks and to even go on vacations, right? Otherwise, I know, of course, a lot of us are drawn to help, drawn to serve. You know, when you see young people, injured and hurt, and when you see others who are concerned, of course, we want to take care of them. But in order to take good care of our community and those around us, we need to take good care of ourselves. Sort of like the oxygen mask analogy, right? When the air pressure changes, to tell you to put on your mask first before you help others. And of course, that is not out of selfishness, because if you pass out while you're helping others, then you're not being effective. right? No one wins in that situation. So we need to give permission to take good care of ourselves so that we can take good care of those around us, right? So this is not a selfish act. In fact, I often tell my students that this is part of our ethical duty as clinicians. If we don't rest, if we don't take good care of ourselves, then we're being unethical because we won't be able to be effective in our work. So it is important that we give permission to ourselves as well as those around us to take breaks. Okay. And now perhaps I can transition into... hold on, I have one more. Actually, I do have slides. I forgot about them. But anyway, so another analogy that I often use is a cup in our heart analogy. So each and every one of us, you can imagine, there is stress every day, right? And stress is not necessarily a bad thing because stress can motivate us or propel us to improve, to be excellent in what we do. So we shouldn't give stress a bad name, right? So stress can, of course, in the long run, no one likes to be stressed all the time. But to help ourselves when we're under stress, there are many, many different ways. One way, using a cup analogy, is to, if stress is water and our capacity is like a cup, then one way, of course, is to, if there's water continuously filling up our cup, we can pour out the water to help us remain okay. Otherwise, it'll be, you know, overflow and we are overwhelmed. So one way to do it is to pour out water, and that's the coping that we talked briefly about. There are things that you can do that you've all been doing when you're stressed. There are things that you know you can do to help yourselves. But another approach is to enlarge the size of that cup. For some people, the size of their cup might be an espresso cup. For some people, it might be a reservoir, size of a reservoir. But that too, even if you have the size of a cup that's the size of a reservoir, there will be one day when it's when you're overwhelmed, right? So we need to work on pouring out the water, as well as learning to enlarge the size of our cup, right? And how do we enlarge the size of a cup? For some people, it might be to remind ourselves why we are doing what we're doing. To remind ourselves our role as followers of Christ. To seek help from above and from around us. Right? To create time of reflection and to grow so that our capacity can enlarge. So we need both. Pouring out the water daily, weekly, monthly, go on vacations, take breaks. But we need to also enlarge the capacity of our inner cup. So those are some of the things that we can do practically. And now I want to quickly transition into helping us see through the lens of social psychology what is happening right now, right? No, so now I would need my slides because it's a little bit complicated. So what we're seeing right now, of course, is a political fiasco, but there are a lot of common elements that we're seeing that is shared by other kind of intergroup conflicts as well. For some reason, our minds are especially attuned to binary oppositions, us and them, day and night, you know, reason and emotion, good and bad, good and evil, yellow and blue, right? So on and so forth. Manchester United versus Liverpool, right? And that is extremely powerful. I always wonder why. In all the team sports games that we have, why is there why are there no games played by three teams together? Now, Mahjong is an exception, right? Four people, but that is individuals. But in terms of team sports, you only see games that consist of two teams, us versus them, right? And in all of our more popular narratives and stories that get passed, transmitted from one generation to another, there's always this very clear good and bad, good and evil narrative. And they are even in some of the stories that we're very familiar with, even in the Bible. So our minds, our human minds are very attuned to this us versus them opposition, right? So currently, of course, there are a lot of these us and them dynamics happening, right? Protesters versus police, white shirt versus black shirt. And interestingly, the kind of description and narratives that we hear from both sides are quite similar, that we are exercising justice, that we are righteous, and the other group is evil. To an extent that we are even using dehumanizing terms. Police are dogs. Protesters they use the word beggar or yellow zombies, right? These are dehumanizing labels that are shortcuts that we like to use because it helps us not deal with really complicated nuances. I mean, it's a little bit too complicated to realize that, okay, police A is a righteous person, but police B is a little bit evil. Police C is not so evil, but sometimes he would hit a protester as well. Police D. So it's very complicated if we are in the midst of a conflict and I have to assess each and every one, their motives, whether they are friend or foe, whether they're going to beat me up or not. But rather, these shortcuts would help me effectively and efficiently make a decision. And we are particularly sensitive to the friend-foe kind of distinction. To an extent that everything that my in-group does is good, and everything that out-group does is bad. And when there are exceptions, for example, let's pretend, I know there are a lot of landmines here, so I'm going to be very careful. when I see an exception to my expectation, I would label it as an exception. So when police officers use force, we would say the police used force, right? Likewise, when the police look at the protesters, when they see several protesters using extreme means, they would say that these are all rioters, right? But if I am a protester and I notice that some of my comrades are using excessive force or violent means, I would say some of us used, you know, like radical means. But when I see one officer, police officer use excessive force, then all of a sudden the entire police force is using excessive force. Right? Of course, when we sit down, we can nod and agree that this is something that we do, but when you're under stress, we often would use that kind of shortcuts. Right? And here I like to bring in in Chinese culture, there's the yin and yang, you know, symbol, right? And that's perhaps, you know, one way to look at it so that we are not so prone to this us and them, is that there's black in white and there's white in black, right? That symbol, and they coexist. So one way for us to understand the current dynamic is that this us and them mentality is extremely, extremely ingrained in our human mind, right? And it's very, very difficult to break out of it, especially when we're under stress, especially when we are on the ground and you see, you know, people wearing the same color charging at you. You're not going to stand there and assess, you know, who is friendly and who's not, right? And that also translates into the way we describe things. Let me use a silly example. So the same behavior, for example, let's say Jack winks at Sue, you know? So that's a concrete behavior. So that's one way of describing it. Jack winks at Sue. But if we already have some preconception about Jack as a person, we might say Jack is flirting with Sue. And if we don't really like Jack as a person, we might say Jack is flirtatious, right? So there are different degrees of abstraction in describing the same behavior. And there is a tendency for us to describe in the abstract level when we see behaviors that are congruent to what we already believe, right? Meaning that, I have to unpack that a little bit, meaning that we already have all sorts of stereotypes about different groups. Let's admit that. Stereotypes are often, we can sometimes modulate them in when we make decisions or our behaviors, but when we're under stress, we rely on stereotypes and shortcuts. And so if a behavior is congruent with our pre-existing stereotypes, we tend to use more abstract terms that describe someone's personality, perhaps, especially if there is already a conflict there. In other words, bringing that back to what's happening right now, if I were a protester, I might attribute the police behavior to them as human beings. They are evil. That's why they are using violence. But when my in-group perhaps perform the same behavior, I would say that is a concrete behavior. A protester charged at the police officer because he was trying to save someone, right? So we will explain that behavior, even though that behavior is the same in the two groups, because it is congruent with my pre-existing beliefs. I would attribute it to that person, something innate about that person. And there's very powerful temptation to do that in this kind of intergroup conflict. So how do we overcome these kind of tendencies, right? One thing that we can consider doing is to give ourselves time, because when, like I said earlier, if we're under pressure, we tend to rely on these shortcuts, right? And we tend to ignore more complex possibilities. So the one thing that we can help ourselves in modulating these tendencies is to give ourselves time and space to think, right? And one common enemy we have when it comes to time and space is busyness and our addiction, in getting updates, right? Or reading different opinions. Again, staying informed is important, but we also need time to reflect. And to create time for reflection requires discipline. But I think that is a duty of ours in this crisis, that we need to learn not to react too quickly. And perhaps it is something we can consider doing is to block off time in our week or in our days to be still and let these more complex nuances challenge us so that we are not reacting. Okay? And of course, another thing we can keep in mind is that crises also give us opportunities to reprioritize things. So I hope that this is also an opportunity for us to really reflect on what is it that young people, or what is it that our neighbors are yearning for, right? And how would that challenge us to reprioritize our lives? So crises are, of course, can be distressing, but they can also provide an opportunity for us to reevaluate what is truly important in our lives. So I would end here, but I would also like to end with a slip in a Pink Floyd from a song that I grew up listening. So us and them, right? And after all, we are only ordinary men and women loved by our one true God. Of course, the ones in parentheses are not in the original lyrics. But I think that's one thing that we can do, knowing that there's this us and them tendency, is to use, and this is, I'm borrowing Pastor Wade's words, use God as our unifier. Christ is our unifier. That's our common identity. So to overcome these intergroup conflicts, we can remind ourselves, what is our common humanity? What is our identity, our true identity, and who is the true enemy? Okay, so I will end there. Thank you.